Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 182, The Effects of Meditation and Cognitive Behavioral Therapy on the Brain, November 14, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I actually have some brain imaging data where I asked people with social anxiety disorder to shift from, oh my gosh, this negative belief, or this person who has with an angry face, spinning on how this reflects something negative about me. And then I give them a cue to shift into just observing the thoughts, feelings, sensations, the reactivity, and how that reactivity changes from moment to moment. So that's a metacognitive shift. And literally seeing how that affects their negative emotion experience to these emotional probes, both behaviorally and then also neurally, what's happening in the brain.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Philippe Golden, a clinical psychologist who spent 6 years in India studying Tibetan Buddhism and is now at Stanford conducting imaging studies on the brain. He'll be one of the featured speakers at the upcoming conference on happiness and its causes in San Francisco on November 24 through November 25. You can find out more about both Philippe and the conference in our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Philippe Golden, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to discussing several things with you. I definitely want to talk about your presentation at the upcoming San Francisco Conference on Happiness and its Causes. But before we get into that, I'd like to focus on your background and your research on mindfulness, meditation, and the brain. Now, I seem to recall that as an undergraduate, you didn't major in psychology at all. Is that right?
Correct. No, my undergraduate degree is in Asian studies.
Very interesting. And sometime after that, was it that you decided to go to India to study Buddhism?
Yeah, well, actually, I did my junior and senior year abroad in Nepal through the University of Wisconsin, Madison. And that exposed me to different languages. I mean, I studied Sanskrit, Tibetan, Nepali languages, and studied Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, and just living in a totally different culture. And that's where my initial exposure to many ideas, including Buddhist ideas, began.
Wow. You must be one of those people who picks up languages pretty easily, because I read that you became a translator as well. What language were you translating from?
Yeah, I was actually studied Tibetan Buddhist practice. For that, I studied Tibetan language in depth and learned both spoken Tibetan and written Tibetan, and also debate language, which is it's also in Tibetan language, but it's a different form of logic and vocabulary and sentence structure. And I was able to become proficient enough to serve as a translator for different teachers and to translate public and private teachings.
Yeah. Wow.
And I really enjoyed the role of being a conduit or a translator.
Wow. Yes. That's really amazing. Fascinating. You studied philosophy, Buddhist philosophy, and debate at a monastery and a dialectic monastic institute. Mm-hmm. I don't think we've heard much about that angle here in the West. I have the impression that there is a branch of Buddhism that regards debate as sort of a specific practice on the road to enlightenment. Is that right? Or?
Yeah, well, within the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and even before that in Indian Buddhism, there are many different schools of Buddhist Buddhist practice and philosophy and so forth, and many of them would engage in discussion or analytic debate, where they would take the words of Shakyamuni Buddha and all the different commentaries and really try to delineate what was being said and what was accurate, what was inaccurate, And that tradition continues to the present. So within Tibetan Buddhism, there are different schools, including the Geluk and Sakya, where they emphasize studying texts, studying philosophy as preparation for sitting and meditating. And then even in more depth, where you spend a lot of time with your colleagues doing fantastic, fun, intellectually stimulating, passionate debate, where you really go at it and try to find out flaws in thinking. And the whole motivation is to identify sources of ignorance, confusion, and to remove them. And this is all preparation for sitting meditation. But in and of itself, the debate has an incredible quality of clarifying the mind.
Fascinating. You know, it puts me in mind, too, of Hasidic Judaism. Isn't there a similar kind of emphasis there on argumentation?
Yes, and lots of debate on language, etymology, the meaning of words and the penumbra of meaning of words, and trying to delineate exactly what even different components of words and mean. And this is all practice of the, this is all in the kind of analytic meditation practice, the clarifying the wisdom component of the mind, so that when you really meditate, or you can use that strength of intellect to pierce into how things abide, how things exist, how things occur. And that really strengthens both concentration and mental clarity.
So I take it that you are a meditation practitioner, and as well as being a scholar on these topics.
They go together.
Yeah, okay.
One most definitely. They feed each other, and then not only to do formal sitting meditation, but to bring that meditation sensibility into the moments throughout the day.
Yes. I'm just wondering if you found that the debate practice and techniques that you studied in the Tibetan language, if those have carried over into your work and your thinking in the English and Western domain?
That's an interesting question. I mean, here it's a little more difficult in Western academic circles to, we don't have the same structure for debate. I think sometimes that goes on in a very slow manner via published articles and like an article and then commentaries and so forth. So that's a very slow process. It's less of a tradition here in our Western, like in our laboratories and amongst our researchers, to actually debate with each other. We do ask each other a lot of questions, but it's a more free-flowing, not structured. But having said that, there are some groups that are trying to incorporate debate. And the debate here is really, the biggest difference here is the motivation. So in the Buddhist tradition, before you start a debate session, everyone together invokes a motivation or an intention to bring one's energy and intellect to remove sources of ignorance, confusion, doubt. That's not always the motivation in Western academic traditions.
I'll say. I'm thinking of some rather difficult department meetings in the academic setting.
Yeah, so I think one of the key things here is intentionality, motivation. Why am I studying this? Why am I meditating on this? Why am I focusing my intellect on this? For what purpose? For what intention?
Are you able to give us an example of the sort of question that you would have debated there in Tibet or in India?
Sure. So, for example, if this very moment when I'm looking at an object, the mental percept in my mind, in my brain, is something that exists, it actually exists in this moment about something that I saw a moment ago. So what's interesting is, do I see the world in a delayed fashion or in the very current moment? So through the five sensory doors, hearing, seeing, touching, smelling, etc., thinking, we are usually seeing the world, the very mental percept arises after the object has been perceived. And then the thoughts about that object, or about that mental representation, are even another step removed in time. So we're kind of always seeing things in a delayed fashion. So then people are saying, so when can you say that a person actually sees an object, or then thinks about an object, or then interprets an object? So we actually delineate all these different steps in from object to perception to thinking to interpreting, elaborating. And that's interesting because that's actually something that often happens in the context of psychotherapy too, where you try to slow down and clarify, okay, now you ended up feeling angry. What happened just before that? What happened just before that? What are the chain of events that led to this current state? So in fact, there is a certain overlap with processes that we do here in Western traditions as well.
Yes, and even Western brain science and so on would have something to say about the delay, you know, how long mm-hmm. neural transmission takes, et cetera.
Yes.
Well, at some point you returned to this country and you completed a PhD in clinical psychology. Given your training in clinical psychology, presumably to be a therapist, how is it that you have become so involved in research? Or was that your goal all along?
You know, actually from the first day of graduate school at Rutgers, I was taking classes in the neuroscience track and in the clinical psychology track, which were in the same department there in psychology. Uh-huh. So from the very first day, I was, I've always been interested in biology, biochemistry, and philosophy and language and et cetera. So from the get-go, I just kept following that. And what I've been able to do really, more so during as a postdoctoral researcher and a research scientist now at Stanford, is simply to integrate all the things that I'm interested in, the brain, the physics of magnetic resonance imaging, meditation, cognitive therapy, treatment for anxiety, depression, and to really bring all those things together. And that's made the waking up and going to work much more passionate.
Yes, how
passion.
Yeah, how wonderful that you found a way to integrate these, and that the world has come to a place, the world of psychology has actually moved along to a place where you're, quotes, allowed to study the intersection of these different passions.
Yeah, there's a huge shift or movement, I would say, momentum building for understanding, you know, what are the sources of empathy, of compassion, both in a workplace, in between people, interpersonally, intrapsychically, what's happening in the brain when a person is in a state of sadness, of compassion for others or compassion for self. And these are topics that maybe a decade ago or a couple decades ago in the neuroscience field would not have been examined, but now there is a huge movement and a lot of energy and money and effort being put into trying to understand these basic and very, very important human processes, compassion, empathy, perception of others, perception of pain in others, because these are part of the human makeup. They're part of the human behavior and experience. So it's a very exciting time.
Yes, indeed. And that's why I'm so excited to talk to you, because you're right on that frontier. Now, I believe you've published some research in which you did fMRI studies of the brain to explore the effects of mindfulness meditation on depression. Maybe you can start out by telling us a bit about mindfulness meditation and then talk about that research.
Yes. So mindfulness meditation is one of many kinds of meditation, and so the mindfulness has to do more with training the mind in kind of adhering to the object, be it internal or external, from moment to moment. And it's one type of practice of building the strength of attention, volitionally, staying in the moment. And so you can think of it as a behavior, and you can think about it as a training of attention and a training of a sensibility about slowing down the processes in the mind that would normally judge, elaborate, criticize, etc., and instead just observing.
Yes.
So we, with my wife Vivek Aramel, back in the San Diego VA, she did a treatment study for people with major depression. There was no brain imaging in that study, but she was looking at mechanisms of change with mindfulness meditation, and there was she was focusing on negative self-focused rumination. So negative self-focused beliefs and spinning on those beliefs, and that the extent to which that tendency went down, that predicted reduction in symptoms of depression, anxiety. And then more recently here at Stanford, I've been able to do a functional brain imaging study using fMRI, one kind of neuroimaging tool, to get under the skull and look at the brain. And that's been with adults with social anxiety or social phobia. And looking at the effects of training in mindfulness meditation versus, say, exercise versus cognitive behavioral therapy, the gold standard psychotherapy, And one of the things we've been finding is that one of the effects of practicing mindfulness meditation is that different forms of emotion regulation, emotional awareness and emotion regulation, become more effective, more efficacious for people who have completed the mindfulness class. So sometimes I talk about this as the WD-40 effect. Like mindfulness somehow infuses the mind with a little more space, a little more fluidity, so that it's so that any type of emotion regulation technique becomes more effective, more easy to implement, in at least in this sample of adults with social anxiety.
Wow, very, very interesting. Yeah. It seems like I'm reading more and more, hearing more and more about studies using this fMRI, functional magnetic resonant imaging. Mm-hmm. Was that a very difficult technique for you to pick up?
I was very fortunate because I was part of an incredible team at the San Diego Veterans Hospital, University of California, San Diego Veterans Hospital, where we, as an interdisciplinary group, worked together in a wonderful fashion. Psychiatrists, psychologists, neuroscientists, computer scientists, physicists, figuring out methods, statistics, different data analytic methods, mm-hmm. To try to figure out how to use this incredible technology, which essentially allows us to let the brain speak for itself rather than self-report, like in a questionnaire.
Yes.
We let the brain show us patterns of activity, and then we, as neuroscientists, have to really work hard to map these patterns of activation onto psychological functions within the context of specific experimental designs. So it's quite challenging in the sense that you have to bring many different domains of thinking, statistics, experimental design, the psychology of the tasks that you're presenting. But it's a wonderful tool. It allows us to let the brain present its own patterns, and to then, which sometimes map onto subjective first-person experience. Sometimes it's different. So, but it's a wonderful tool. We're still in the infancy of brain imaging techniques for humans.
Yes.
And I think we'll be, as technology advances, we'll have more and more better resolution and better techniques for analyzing and modeling how the brain works. It's beautifully complex.
Yes, at this point, it seems like it's a fairly gross measurement, although it's leaps beyond what existed before.
Correct.
But definitely there's room to for more finer sorts of measurement.
Yeah, and there are many different neuroimaging tools, all of which have pros and cons, strengths and weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
One of the movements has been to try to combine different types of imaging technologies together. And that also is complex as well, because they give us very different signals, both in terms of resolution, spatial resolution, and also temporal resolution. So, but that's what we're here for. It's these very powerful challenges, and there are a lot of smart people trying to work on this.
Well, I think that all of your discipline in meditation and debate, harnessing your own mind and concentration, must come to play in your ability to focus on and integrate all of these complex topics.
Mm-hmm. With the students, my students I work with, I'm always encouraging them to sit, slow down, and meditate on the data.
With so much to do, it's really hard, with this Western brain to get that it could be useful and valuable to just sit and do, quotes, nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you ever wrestle with that, or have you wrestled with that?
Well, life right now tends to be so busy. Well, there are certain small steps that we can take. So, for example, what would it be like to turn the TV off? What would it be like to perhaps even turn the radio off? What would it be like to just sit with a cup of tea on your porch or in your kitchen and just slow down? In fact, that's on a personal level, but on an institutional level, there are both clinics, research labs, institutions, businesses that are encouraging people to slow down in order to be more creative, to have better health, to feel more at ease at work, and even with employees, because I think long-term we're realizing that these are very, very important skills to maintain well-being and creativity.
Yes.
And productivity.
Yes. Yeah. Now, on my own personal note, I saw that you have a 2008 study on which you were a team member on having to do with tinnitus or ringing in the ears. Now, I'm a tinnitus sufferer myself. So what's the latest from the research frontier on that topic?
Yeah, so tinnitus, this painful perception of sound in the ears, clearly some of the sequelae that arise from having that problem, more anxiety, more depression, more stress. So some of the ideas of using cognitive behavioral therapy or stress reduction training of some kind to help reduce the anxiety and maybe symptoms of depression that arise from this persistent, painful auditory experience. That's one of the things that people have been approaching. The other thing is to try to see, is there something in the brain that can tell us when a person is hearing sound in a normal manner, and then hearing sounds that are more of this buzzing nature that are interfering. And then the possibly longer step is there a way to provide specific forms of training to help people modulate their own brain activity? So in other areas, that's happening. That hasn't yet happened for tinnitus, but that's definitely something. Because right now, when we use the word neuroplasticity or the ability for people to train their own brain activity, there are techniques like real-time fMRI that allow us to give feedback to people in the moment on their own brain activity. So can a person modulate parts of their brain networks to reduce the perception of sound? Well, in fact, in meditation, we know there are techniques for doing that, where people begin to shut down the perception of sound, smell, taste, etc. I haven't seen anyone try to map that onto tinnitus. So that would be a very fruitful area.
Well, I can tell you that the way that I've dealt with it, you'd be interested in, because it's really kind of a meditative way, which is when I become aware of it. And it's kind of like the refrigerator running in the background. Much of the time I'm not aware of it. If I'm absorbed in some task, if I'm doing something that I'm really absorbed in, then I'm totally unaware of it. And yet at the same time, it's loud enough that I noticed when I tried taking up motorcycle riding again, and I decided not to, I must say, but I could hear the tinnitus over the sound of a loud motorcycle and the wind in my ears. Mm. So it's loud, but but it kind of comes and goes. So what I've tried, the attitude I've tried to take towards it, instead of making it the occasion for anxiety and alarm, is just a reminder to bring myself into the present, a reminder to remember God or the bigger picture, or whatever, as you will.
I like that.
Yeah, I do too, and it kind of seems to work for me. Well, let's... go ahead.
No, the idea of reframing what this means.
So yes.
When I hear this sound, this is the sound of angels, this is the sound of God, this is the sound of some benevolent force reminding me to stay in the present.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a great way to reframe and use it.
Yeah, thank you. Well, let's talk about the upcoming Happiness Conference in San Francisco. And by the way, I'll be sure to put a link to the conference website in the show notes so that people can get more information. But tell us a bit about the conference.
Yeah, so happiness and its causes is something like a movement in order to raise awareness about the sources of happiness. So, for example, there's a wonderful book by Mathieu Ricard called Happiness that came out a couple of years ago, where I think he basically says that happiness is a skill. It's a skill that can be developed, and it behooves us to learn how our own mind works, what are the pitfalls, what are the cul-de-sacs that we kind of go into, what are the habits that prevent us from experiencing happiness from moment to moment at different levels. So the conference is, in this case, it has been done in Australia, it's been done in London, and now in San Francisco, coming at the in a few weeks, actually now in November. And Rubina Khordan, Venerable Rubina Khordan, a Tibetan Buddhist nun, is kind of spearheading it. But she's invited all kinds of people, social workers, lawyers, conflict resolution people, psychologists, psychiatrists, neuroscientists, all kinds of people to come and speak about the sources of happiness. What are the things that might help support or facilitate well-being, compassion, etc. So it's going to be a very interesting, dynamic set of talks and discussions.
It really does look like it's going to be that indeed, and I plan to be there, and I look forward to meeting you there. And as I looked at, when I first heard about it, you know, and I looked through the speakers, I was expecting to see a lot of names that I would recognize from the positive psychology movement. I didn't see any. It looks to me like it's primarily coming from a Buddhist perspective. Do you know if there, you know, there has been a lot of work in what's being called positive psychology. I'd be interested in your take on that and whether you see any sort of intersection or cross-cutting between the Buddhist take on happiness and what's happening in the world of positive psychology.
Yeah, I do believe that there's an overlap. I think for the purpose of the conference, Rubina Khordan was interested in getting people from all different domains. So there are filmmakers, there are social workers, there are, you know, athletes, there are coaches, and so forth. So because happiness can arise, and I think people are working on that in many different domains, including, you know, businesses. We have people from Google coming as well. In terms of positive psychology, because this is really in contrast to the medical model, which is mostly about psychopathology or pathology. What's wrong with the body, the person, the system? And the positive psychology is rising and contrasting. So here we have human beings. What are the skills, the aptitudes, the abilities that people can develop to become optimal, to function more optimally, to actually experience joy, take responsibility for enhancing their compassion for self, for others, empathy, care, and how can people take situations that and take a perspective or reinterpret situations in order to make them less toxic. So the positive psychology is very interesting in that it's really enhancing positive qualities in people, not just focusing on anxiety, depression, schizophrenia, substance abuse. And that's a very, I think, healthy balance that's arising in both psychology and in medicine and so forth. I think it's a representation that people are, that people recognize that they want to be even more well, and that we can be. And it even raises the question, what are the extents, what is the extent or the limit of well-being?
Yeah, and you know, I think too that they have been generating data showing that qualities like generosity and forgiveness and passionate engagement, that these kinds of things are associated with happiness. And it seems to me that, you know, you were talking earlier about the Buddhist take on compassion. It mm-hmm. does seem like there's overlap there.
Yes, no, definitely. And there definitely is overlap, and I think that, I mean, just from a mechanism point of view, you can think, as I was mentioning earlier, about this negative self-rumination. When my attention is focused on myself, and if I have the habit of negative thinking about the self, this leads to low self-esteem. What would happen if every day I practiced positive affirmation about myself? I am fine the way I am. I'm doing a good job. I am a good mother or father, a good person. And what does it mean to be generous to others? What is, you know, in both in terms of giving material goods, but also just wishing well? Like, so for example, get on the bus, walk into a mall, see other human beings, and just think, may that person be well. May that person have a sense of ease. Just practicing that could be very powerful. And as you mentioned, forgiveness. How much energy in the mind and body is encapsulated into revenge or into anger about others? And to release that, I forgive. I forgive. Both I forgive myself, I forgive others. And this is something that I think is empirical. People need to just practice it in themselves and see the results for themselves.
Yes, there are ample opportunities for practice at Walmart and other such places.
Walmart, the bus, yeah. The mall, at home.
Yes, yes, there are challenges all around.
Everywhere.
Yes. Without giving it all away, can you give us a bit of a foretaste of what you'll be talking about in your presentation?
Metacognitive perspective, cognitive perspective taking. So there's one of the mechanisms that Zindel Siegel, who's a fantastic clinical psychologist researcher at the University of Toronto, that he's proposed is this idea of decentering, or that the contents of my awareness, be it my thoughts, my emotions, my memories, my sensations, to what extent do I reify those? Like, that's me, that thought, that feeling, that emotion is me, as opposed to decentering, stepping back, and just seeing them as momentary experiences, phenomena. And in one way, this can be conceptualized as metacognition, reflecting on how I relate to the contents of my awareness. So I think that this is a key trainable mechanism or aptitude for decentering from the contents of awareness, so that instead of getting stuck reifying, ossifying the contents of my awareness, I can actually make them more fluid and see that I am a person who has these experiences, but those experiences are not the definition of me. So I actually have some brain imaging data where I asked people with social anxiety disorder to shift from, oh my gosh, this negative belief, or this person who has with an angry face, spinning on how this reflects something negative about me. And then I give them a cue to shift into just observing the thoughts, feelings, sensations, the reactivity, and how that reactivity changes from moment to moment. So that's a metacognitive shift. And literally seeing how that affects their negative emotion experience to these emotional probes, both behaviorally and then also neurally, what's happening in the brain. So I'll be just briefly talking about this as one tool for, as a mechanism for bringing about happiness. Is to be free from the automatic habitual reactivity might be a source for happiness.
All right. Well, Philippe, as we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to leave our listening audience with?
Yes. So in our research lab here at Stanford in the psychology department, we are very fortunate to be conducting two different studies for adults with social phobia, social anxiety disorder. We offer for free training and treatment for social anxiety. So what I would encourage is we are encouraging people to contact us, and our number is 650-723-5977. That's 650-723-5977. And we are actively looking for adults in the area who have social anxiety, social phobia, to participate in training and treatment that we offer for free for as part of a research study.
How would I know if I have social anxiety and whether or not I have social anxiety that's severe enough to warrant your interest?
Yeah, so social anxiety is characterized by an intense fear of social or performance situations where I'm worried that I might do something or say something to humiliate or embarrass myself and or make people think badly of me. So there's usually an intense fear of social situations, performance situations, giving talks, dating, interacting with others, and or in a very strong avoidance. So I actually have sculpted my life by avoiding all kinds of situations that I fear. And I think that this is something that everyone has to some degree, but it exists on a continuum. And we actually do phone screens and diagnostic interviewing and so forth. And I think a lot of people, hopefully people will recognize that it's not just shyness, but it's actually a more extreme that really interferes with interpersonal functioning, how a person feels in different situations. So, but if you need more clarification, please call us.
Okay, well, I'll be sure to put that phone number in our show notes as well. Dr. Philippe Golden, thanks so much for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Great. Thank you so much. Be well.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Philippe Golden. The lab phone number, if you want to be involved in the study on social anxiety, is 650-723-5977. And also, there is a website that you can go to, and that's http://caan.stanford.edu. And CAAN is phonetically is what? California Alpha Alpha Nancy. The conference website you'll find at www.happinessanditscausessf.com. Or you can do what I do, which is to do a Google search on Happiness Conference San Francisco, and that'll bring it up. I have to say I'm very impressed with Philippe Golden, so much so that it's all I can do to hang on to any shreds of self-esteem. Let's see, he reads, writes, and speaks Tibetan, among other Asian languages. For my part, I can speak halting Pig Latin and a smattering of butchered Spanish. He's able to debate the fine points of Buddhist philosophy with Tibetan masters. I can sometimes answer questions from undergraduates. I'm sure he's able to focus his concentration like a laser beam drilling a hole through metal while the drunken monkey of my mind is still quite drunk. He gets to play with high-tech toys like fMRI devices. My highest tech is an iPhone. He does trailblazing research and I... But wait a moment. Time to take a deep breath or two. Bring myself back into this moment in which he and I and you are all perfect. If any of you are able to attend the Happiness Conference, be sure to say hi. I'll be that perfect being in a black shirt that says Shrink Wrap Radio.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. And Dr. Dave is here to remind you it's all in your mind.
As you may have heard in one of the previous two episodes, I'm trying to switch to a donations model instead of an advertising model. So you'll notice there was no advertising pre-roll at the beginning of the show, and I'll not be discussing any affiliate sponsors now. The only endorsement I will make is for something that both you and I love, namely Shrink Wrap Radio. So far, six people have made donations, and I'm extremely grateful to them for their support. You know who you are. And five of these are ongoing donations for the next 12 months. Now that's support I can really count on. Six is a great start, of course, but it'll take more than that for me to feel that the donation model is the way to go for the future. According to our listener survey, most of you listen while away from your computer. As a matter of fact, nearly 75% of you are probably away from your computer as you're listening to this. Right now, most of you will be in the car, or on a run, or on a walk, or working in the garden, or working out in the gym. And I know most of you get the show through iTunes or an RSS feed, which means you probably aren't going to the website. So wherever you are, whatever you're doing, pick up a nearby stone or some other object and put it in your pocket as a reminder to go to the website and make a donation. It'll make you feel so good, I promise.
Hi, this is Dr. Michael Pinkston from Santa Rosa, California. And I'm at the ISAD Dream Conference, and you're in a lucid dream with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Michael. Dr. Mike Pinkston is one of my good friends who I have yet to entice onto Shrink Wrap Radio as a guest. Just yesterday, we got together to hit some tennis balls back and forth. So let's check into some emails from our listener community. I'm going to jump ahead to one of the most recent because it raises an issue I need additional feedback on. It's from another Michael who writes, Dr. Dave, I'm really perplexed, not so much by the issue of the imbalance in the levels between your voice, booming and distorted, and that of your interviewee, normal and undistorted, but by the fact that your voice is always overdriven, booming, and distorted. I stopped downloading your podcast for a while because of it, but recently I downloaded number 180 and found that your voice is just as booming and distorted as ever, while Nova Spivak's levels are perfect. Of course, I had to turn the volume down because your voice was so loud and distorted, which forced me to listen more intently so as not to miss what he was saying. Your comments only served as an annoying distraction, pulling me off topic as I kept asking myself why. He says, I download about 10 podcasts a week, mostly from PBS, plus All in the Mind from ABC Radio National, and none of them plays back distorted. So I feel it's safe to say this is not a local issue. Of course, I have to insert here that they have much more resources than I do. I'm just one guy operating out of a room in my house. But still, I am concerned about this feedback. Michael goes on to say, what perplexes me is that it continues. Is it possible that you aren't aware of the problem? Yes, I was not aware of it. That seems odd since you are a self-professed techie, and no self-respecting techie would miss such poor production values. Actually, I responded to Michael saying that I'm a techie in matters of electronics and computers to some degree, but not so much in the area of sound. This has been a new and challenging technical arena for me, but I thought I was getting on top of it. He goes on to say, is it possible that none of your listeners have brought this to your attention in all this time? Yes, it is possible. I have not heard about this before. He says, I know I have in one of your surveys. Is it possible that your input meter isn't working correctly? If it were, I expect it would always be pegged when you're speaking. Or is it possible that you just don't know how to fix it? It's more unfortunate because I find your subjects fascinating and your guests interesting. I would listen far more often except for this addle persistent issue. Respectfully, Michael. Well, Michael, I do appreciate that feedback because if there's something wrong here, I need to know about it. And I do want to fix it, and I'm not sure I know how to fix it, but I would figure it out. I really need to hear from other listeners on this issue. I thought I had pretty much licked my sound problems. I've listened back to recent shows, including the number 180 that Michael mentions, and I don't hear the problem he's describing. In follow-up correspondence, Michael let me know that he's been a sound engineer, so I'm sure he has more training than I do in this area, and perhaps a more trained ear. Let me know if you're also finding my voice to be distorted and booming. On a happier note, Mark writes, Hi David, thank you for a fascinating interview with Dr. Tatkin, which I've just finished listening to for the third time. I'm so pleased that you were able to interview him. Are you open to other interviewee suggestions? Are you aware of the positive psychologist Don Baker? And he provides a short profile. Author of What Happy People Know. He's an engaging speaker, although I appreciate that you've already covered positive psychology in the podcast. All the best from London, Mark. Well, it's interesting suggestion that Mark makes because I've had a book on my bookshelf sent to me by a publisher, and I'd been meaning to get around to this book, and it is, in fact, by Dan Baker. And the title is a little bit different. I think it's a slightly newer book. It's called What Happy Women Know, How New Findings in Positive Psychology Can Change Women's Lives for the Better. So I'm going to be following up and trying to get in touch with Dan Baker and see if I can line him up as a guest. I agree, Mark. That's a great suggestion. I'm always happy to hear from listener and two-time guest, Sarah Hannah Radcliffe, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I just had to tell you how much I enjoyed your discussion with Jerry Trumbull on technology and the millennials. You two are so down-to-earth and refreshingly open about your experiences with all the new technologies. I myself have been pretty confused about Twitter, and your discussion was informative and reassuring at the same time. I think people of a certain age, digital immigrants as we're now being called, have a bit of a love-hate thing going on with all the new communication tools and media. I really identified with so much of what each of you were saying. I also enjoyed your interview on Wise Counsel with Dr. Dave Gordon on the topic of his book, Unstuck. I found him so impressive, particularly because of his ability to take complementary medicine to the level of communities and governments." She goes on to say, "This is what we really need, and it reminds me that I want to talk to you about Bach flower therapy someday. Everything that I've ever done, which has been considered fringe, seems to have found its way recently into mainstream thinking. Do you remember when meditation was so weird that Dr. Herbert Benson had to name the process the relaxation response in order to talk about it at Harvard University? Now look at where we are with that. I'm pretty sure that one day Bach flowers and energy psychology will be offered in every medical office in the country. On a completely different note, I know that you've stopped reading the complete bios of people you interview, but I really miss that. I have always enjoyed those introductions as they help me get a sense of who I'm about to listen to. I know we can look them up on the website, but realistically, who has the time? I wish you'd go back to the old way. I wonder if anyone else has thoughts on this. Anyway, take care, Dr. Dave, and keep up the fantastic work, Sarah Hanna." Okay, a bunch of issues in here that I'd like to respond to. I guess, first of all, again, I need some additional feedback on this issue of the shorter bios that I've been giving in the audio version and putting a longer version on the web. That gets back to the issue that I raised in relation to donations, that probably most of my listeners aren't going to the web. And so, as Sarah points out, you're also being deprived, I guess, of a fuller background description of the interviewee. I started doing this as a result of attending the New Media Expo in Las Vegas, where all the podcasters gather, and a presentation that kind of made the point that you really need to get into the heart of your content very quickly or you'll lose listeners. So I thought, okay, maybe I'm taking too much time with these intros and I need to get right into the interview much faster. So that's what led me to start doing that. I would like to hear from more of you whether you like the new format of the shorter bio background or whether you agree with Sarah Hanna and would like the fuller description on air. And let's see, what else in there? I agree with your point, Sarah, about that such things as energy psychology and who knows, maybe Bach flower therapy might become more mainstream as time goes by. I've been struck by how meditation has become such a mainstream research topic now. You know, I did my doctoral dissertation a long time ago on meditation as part of what I was doing. And at the time, you know, I was really on the leading edge. Unfortunately, I didn't stay with that line of research, or I might have been one of those big names that you hear about today. So really, there were a lot of other people of my generation who did go on and do a lot of research and who have become those big names, and I've been interviewing some of them here on the show. And so you're right. It's sort of, if remembering the Thomas Kuhn writing about paradigm shifts, and says one of the things that's required for the paradigm to shift is the dinosaurs die off and the young bucks come in and take over a field. And so that's how new ideas can begin to enter the mainstream. And so you might be right. I don't know much about the Bach flower therapy thing, and, you know, my initial response is pretty skeptical, but I really trust Sarah Hanna Radcliffe as being a very solid person, and so I will interview you at some point on that. And thanks for your feedback about the shows with Jerry Trumbull. And I guess we're overdue to do another one. I'll have to check in with him and see maybe what we've got on the burner that we could get into. So I think that'll wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink at shrinkwrapradio. You can leave comments about the individual shows on our website. You can leave voicemails on Skype where I'm ShrinkPod. You can leave voicemails using my Chingo on the website. You can use our phone number at 206-337-0622. Thanks again to Philippe Golden for sharing his uniquely fascinating background as well as his cutting-edge research. And speaking of meditation research, next week's guest will be University of Washington researcher Dr. Alan Marlatt, who, among other things, has been studying mindfulness meditation in relation to addiction and relapse prevention. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.